have a plan, implement it, and then understand that it's not going to be what you expect, and then be like cool with the new thing that life gives you.
Welcome to the Productivityist Podcast. It's me, Mike Vardy, and on the program this time around, I'm joined by Misha Gluberman. Misha has a course called How to Talk to People About Things. He is the co-author of the book, The Chairs Are Where the People Go, which The New Yorker named one of its top nonfiction books of 2011. And there are a lot of interesting things that we get into during this conversation, which we recorded several months back, but I'm glad to get it out there to you now. I mean, he teaches communication skills and he runs meetings and conferences for organizations, hosts live events and speaks at conferences. This conversation, I think it's not only a testament to what he's done, but what we can also look forward to. As this episode is being released, we're on the tail end, or so it seems, of COVID-19 and the pandemic. So I want you to take this episode and listen to it with that that optimism in mind, and what we have to look forward to when we can all start to get back together again. I know I'm planning on hosting a live event in September of 2022, and I'll share more on that in the future. But right now, what I want to share with you is this conversation with Misha Gluberman here on the Productivityist Podcast. Just before we jumped on the call, I said, you know, I was reading the book that you kind of, it was about you in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
It was called The Chairs Are Where the People Go. And just before we jumped on, you said to me, like, Mike, that book, how old is that book, Misha? Tell me how long ago that book was written.
I think it's about 10, a little over 10 years ago.
So as we, you know, we're in a new year now, a new calendar year, and things change, right? So first thing I want to talk about is
that's like the understatement of 2020.
So what's changed between the book and like where you were in the book? Because there's lots of fascinating stories that, you know, you talk about improv and your own thoughts. And there's some really interesting, I mean, I love reading books where it's like little short, almost not essays, but like just blips and thoughts and things and insights. And what do you think has changed between when this book was published and where you're at now? Like, who is Misha now compared to who
you mentioned? Do you mean what's changed in the world or what's
for you?
Oh man, a lot. I mean, a lot happened in the intervening 10 years, and then a lot happened just in the last year since the book, because I mean, in the last year since the pandemic and everything. But I mean, I wrote that book when that book is a book. I guess probably most people listening to this haven't read the book, although they should. The book is, I mean, when I wrote that book is sort of about a lot of work I was doing in Toronto at the time. Where I still live. And a lot of the work that I was doing there was sort of work in the arts and in a kind of, there was a kind of social world that was happening in Toronto around social work, around social stuff, around the arts. And so a lot of the book sort of describes that world. What's happened in my life since then is I'm like 10 years older and my life is a bit more of a professional life. I still have some connection to that arts world in Toronto, but a lot more of what I do now is just is work helping people communicate better and talk about difficult issues at work, at home, that kind of stuff. So I'm a bit more of a grown up. And I have a kid, I have a family. I didn't have those things when I wrote the book.
See, it's fascinating because I would say 10 years ago that I was doing comedy and I was doing, I was just getting out of that world, getting into the productivity space. We had my first daughter, my only daughter, and we had my son 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. So, I mean, it's fascinating that things can change, but like you said earlier, what in the last year, lots of stuff has changed. One of the things you've been focusing on is, as COVID-19, and I know we try to keep this podcast as timeless as possible, but the thing about the pandemic is it didn't exactly come and go, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's trying to keep itself as timeless as possible. Sadly, too, that's what the virus seems to be doing.
So that's something that you've taken on, the building connection and communicating during this time, right? So what led you to that? What made you say, you know, this is something I really want to focus on?
To focus on building connection during the pandemic.
Yeah, thing? Yeah.
I was, I don't know, it was really interesting. Those first couple of weeks of the pandemic, which are now a long time ago, it's hard to remember them, and it's hard to remember them how we perceive them. But I think one thing I saw in a lot of people, it happened to me and it happened to a lot of people too, is a lot of people, it kind of upped their energies for certain kind of stuff and upped their energies for thinking about what mattered and stuff like that. And I think we forget, like in the first couple of weeks in the pandemic, there was this sense of like now we're all sort of tired. You know, we're all right, like, yeah. The fact of time, it's like, oh man, this is exhausting. But in the first couple of weeks, what we were sort of like terrified, like, or at least a lot of people, there was this sense of like, oh my God, we're all going to die. Like, what's happening? And having that experience, I think for a lot of people led them to, a lot of people I know, led them to sort of think about what they really mattered. And what really mattered. I remember in that time thinking like, oh, okay, like maybe something really terrible is happening in the world. Like maybe this is like the start of a, you know, a world war or something like that. And one of the things I really remember thinking really explicitly was I was like, you know, you kind of look back on World War II, and I run a business, I run a small business. And I kind of thought, oh, you know, you look back on World War II and there's probably some guy you can point to and be like, you know, that guy, he really figured out how to make his business be successful during World War II. And then there's some other guy you can look at and be like, you know, that guy, he figured out how to be really helpful in the world during World War II. And I was like, I would like to be the second guy. Like, I don't want to be the guy who's like, you know, I was like, that seems like a good thing to do. And so I kind of looked at it. I was like, well, what does the world need? And what do I know how to do? And at the time, and still, I think, people were like, wow, this is really scary. We feel really isolated. And I was like, well, what do I know how to do? I know how to build community. And I'm pretty good with computers. So I thought, well, I'll just start trying to do that and start figuring out what we can do on, you know, using online tools and using Zoom and using all those tools that everyone was hating. Mm-hmm. But to sort of say, like, what can we actually do to have that be sources of meaningful connection? So I spent in the first couple of months of the pandemic, a lot of my time was spent just doing one after another, these kinds of online experiments to get people together, to try to see if people could build meaningful connection and feel less isolated using those tools and sort of bypass the, you know, harness the strengths of those tools and get around the weaknesses of them. So that was what I did. That's the long answer to a short question.
And that, to that end, I mean, people have been, you know, thrust into using, you know, Zoom and all these tools. How do you make, I mean, and I think this is a challenge people are going to face going forward anyway, because now that there's a familiarity around these tools, how do you make it so that it is not something that is drudgery or just rote? You know what I mean? Like, how do you make it engaging? Because there's lots of virtual events that are happening. People just, everyone went that way, right? They had to. They had no choice.
Yeah, there's
no... How do you make it so that it you know, you've got this interesting, unique experience, or like what goes into that? That's something that I've been seeking, because otherwise it just seems like, okay, it's just another Zoom call, or oh, it's just another virtual conference, or what have you.
I'm curious, what have you been seeing in virtual conference? Can I ask you, what have you been seeing in virtual conferences that's boring you?
Well, I think what's happened, what I've seen is the online summits that existed before, no one really challenged how to take the offline experience, because I loved going to, you know, San Diego and Austin and places like that to be around people and have the energy of that experience when you'd actually go to conferences. And what I've seen is just a massive amount of online summits that are still doing what online summits always did, but with this idea like, hey, this is how events happen now. Like, this is just what it is. There's no inventiveness. There's I don't see people trying to recapture or even try to, like, say, you know, get the energy that you could get from being in a live environment. And that's something that I don't know if we can get it, but I'd like to see people try, maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because otherwise it just seems like a waste. I mean, it seems like it's not a good use of your time. People often I've seen lots of people say, well, why, you know, Stephen Pressfield famously said, don't go to workshops, don't go to, like, going to conferences, you know, some people go there just to say that they're doing something, but in often cases they don't, you know, like some people just, but now that they're, you know, there's a screen and you're staying at home, it's like, okay, well now, you know, is it even less worth, you know, worthy of my time? And I want these things to be worthwhile.
Do you meet people when you go to real world conferences? Do you make valuable connections with people at those conferences?
Absolutely. That's the reason I go. I think it's the magic in the hallways and the magic in the middle that happens. I mean,
when you go to virtual, have you made a lot of connections at virtual conferences?
Virtual conferences, not so much, because there's this.
So that's the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem.
That seems to me to be the problem So if that's that helps me, because the problem that you report anecdotally from your experience, I'm going to take your problem and I'm going to just boil it down to two sentences. What I'm going to get from two sentences is, when I go to real conferences, I feel the presence of other people and it's exciting. And in terms of actually useful outcome, I meet people, I make connections at them. And when I go to virtual conferences, those things don't happen. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's a problem you can design for, I think. Like if you're putting on a, I mean, you can sort of design for it as an attendee, that's harder, but you can design for it a lot as a conference designer. And I think people don't. And I think people actually don't, I think people don't design for that very well with online conferences. And I think the deep dark secret is I think people actually don't design that very well for real life conferences either, for in-person conferences either. They're just lucky that it kind of works out, even right. though they don't design for it. So one of the things that I do a lot with conferences is when I work with people who organize conferences, what I try to impress upon them, and this is both online and offline, but let's focus on the online case, mm-hmm. I think, because that seems more relevant. What I try to impress upon them is that when you're designing a conference, it's really easy to think that the conference is about, for instance, the content, that the conference is about like who the speakers are going to be and what they're going to talk about. And if there's a live conference, you also think the conference is about the chicken, you know, like about like the food, like you're like, let's make sure the meals are really good and let's make sure the space looks really nice mm-hmm. and let's figure out who the speakers are. And all that stuff's great. But the belief that I have is that for most people, where the real value of conference lies is in the connections that they create with people. And a huge problem you can make in conference design is designing the conference and as if all those other things were the main function. And that's especially even more true, I think, for an online conference, that if I'm going to go to an online conference, if what I'm looking for is interesting, informative video to watch, mm-hmm. and I'm sitting at my desk, at my computer, there is literally a lifetime's worth of interesting, informative video to watch. Like for you to say, hey, Misha, we're going to throw a conference. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to give you 7 hours of interesting, informative video. I'm like, that's not, except in very special situations, that's not a problem I have in my life is a shortage of interesting, informative video of professional interest to me. Like there's an infinite amount of it. What you need to do is help me meet people who I want to meet and who want to meet me. And you can do that, but you have to really design for it. And so a lot of that just means building in lots and lots and lots of structures where you turn your participants to each other, where you get people to talk to each other, and where you and you need to design both technologically and socially. So you want to have technologies that allow people to talk to each other and meet each other and find each other in whatever formats work best for them. I love video. I love small group video stuff, but I've also seen people do good stuff with chat and good stuff with that. I think as a supplement to video, I think you need the video for that actual feeling you've met someone. And then also doing the social design that makes it possible for people to do things like find the people who share their interests, make it easy for them for people who might want to talk to each other, to find each other, to make it easy for them to stay in touch with each other, to give them social permission to leave conversations that are boring, all that kind of stuff. So you can design for all of it, but I would say 99% of conferences don't do anything.
Why do you think that? Is it just because it's hard? Is that why? Is it hard to do, or is it hard to measure the ROI of it? Like why? Because I think there's opportunity there. You've said so, and I believe that. But why do you think they don't?
It's funny. I have very strong opinions that I think are really right about how a conference should be run. Mm-hmm. I have only stabs in the dark as to why it is the conferences as to this question that you ask about why people don't do that. Yeah, I think there's a few things. I think from the point of view of organizers, I think for any of us, in almost any, I mean, I teach communication. I think that one of the biggest things in communication, which is always true, is like, oh, it's really hard to see things from the other guy's point of view. It's just always really hard to like, whatever you're doing, it's really hard to think about how it is for other people. So if you're throwing I don't know why this example is in my head. It's a weird example, but it's relevant. It's very relevant to conferences. Maybe mm-hmm. if you're throwing a dinner party, and like you're making dinner for people, and you're making a dinner party, and like you make the roast and you make like this potato salad, and then like the potato salad is supposed to have dill in it, and you run out of dill and you make the potato salad without dill. If you're a normal person, what you're gonna be is like, I'm like, oh man, there's supposed to be dill in the potato salad, like crap, like this, you know. Mm-hmm. No guest's experience is actually gonna be diminished by the fact that there's not dill in the potato salad. But like from them, that doesn't matter. They're there to have a nice time, talk to each other, have a drink or two. But for you, all those details feel super duper important.
Right.
As a conference organizer, I think you're in a similar position where like you're going to be really worried about like, you know, oh, does it make sense to put this speaker before that speaker or after that speaker? Or how are we going to get that guy in from Denver in time? Or, you know, is the chicken going to be good? Like all of those things, you're thinking about all those things. And so they seem really important. And like you say, too, about measurables, you can see them all.
Right.
So you can see the speaker going up on stage. You can see the music coming up. You can see the decorations you put in the room. But the most important thing that happens in the conference is the conversation that happens in the hallway, or even not in the hallway, in the airport, on the way home. After the conference is technically over, two people who are at the conference meet at the, you know, meet on the plane. And they're like, oh my God, I saw you in that thing. You know, all that stuff, which is the really valuable stuff, is also not so visible to you. And it's also out of your control a little bit. So I think it's harder. And then I also think, so that's one reason. There are things that are really, really, really important to us as humans that it's hard for us to say are important to us as humans. So I think, and I think one example of that is our need for connection. So I think the reality is that for most of us in our work, we need connection with other people. We need connection partly because it's how we learn and get good at our work. And partly because we need it emotionally, because for our work to feel satisfying and rewarding and well integrated in our lives, we need to feel connected to other people. But I think our culture doesn't super duper encourage us to say that. So I think it's hard for a conference to say, you know, so it's easy for a conference to say, you know what's going to happen? There are going to be these learning outcomes. You're going to come to this conference and you're going to learn these 7 skills. And we can all be like, yes, that's clearly important to me. I need 7 skills. But if a conference say, listen, you're going to come to this conference and you're going to like meet 4 people who are people in your field who are going to become dear friends and colleagues, that somehow feels like something you shouldn't be spending $2,000 for, even though in fact, it's much more valuable. I mean, if you look at the actual value, just in terms of like what you care about as a person, or even what's going to help you make more money, having good, strong relationships with people who share your interests and you care about is going to be much more valuable. But we tend to undervalue that. It doesn't feel...
Well, we also don't know if we don't see the payoff right away. I mean, I went to the World Domination Summit years ago, the first one, and I was going regularly. Yeah. And the connections that I built there, the friendships, the ROI, if you want to use that term, you don't see it right away, but it compounds, right? Like, I mean, I can connect with, James Clear. I met James Clear at the first World Domination Summit. Right. We had drinks at the Ace Hotel. I was there when they were doing handstands outside like that. You know, I mean, that's before James Clear wrote Atomic Habits, all that stuff. So you don't know, you just don't know. But the connecting with people in those, wouldn't say mundane things, but those activities that fall outside of the parameters of the conference per se, they're so massive.
Yeah. No, and I like that idea. I like that idea of those payoffs. I mean, one thing I'm very aware of is as humans, for most of us, we really, really, really have a bias toward, like an unfortunate bias towards payoffs that are certain, near-term, and clear, whereas it would often serve us better to pursue things that are more uncertain, more long-term, and maybe a little more unclear. So that's a really great example. You're like, yeah, I meet this person, you know, I attended this workshop and I learned these 3 skills, and I could be like, yeah, now I know these 3 skills or these 3 facts. I could have also learned them from a web page in 3 minutes, but I did learn them. I can be like, yep, I know that. Mm-hmm. Bam. Whereas like, oh, I met these 8 people. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen? But of course, you meet 8 people every once in a while, and next thing you know, you've got this amazing network of people, and it's the most important thing in your life, you know?
Yeah, it's,
but it also might not be. That's the truth. That's the hard thing, both for the organizers and the attendees. That if I teach a workshop and I'm like, here are the 7 learning points, you'd be like, yeah, I got all 7 learning points. But if you run a thing where it's like, yeah, you might make some friends, you also might not. I can't guarantee that you're going to make a friend. I can guarantee you to talk to some people. Can't guarantee you're going to love them or stay in touch. You know.
All right, we're going to take a break from my conversation with Misha to talk about our sponsors. I know what I like to look at. I'm sure you do too. And when I'm building assets for the Productivityist brand and for my work and, you know, things like thumbnails, opt-ins, this podcast artwork, the podcast artwork that you're looking at as you stare at your device or look at your desktop to listen to me talk about the tools that I use and the conversations that I have and all that stuff, I just want to make sure that they look great. And I don't have the experience to make that happen on my own. I'm not trained in that area. I don't have the budget necessarily to do that either. And I certainly don't have the time. But with Canva Pro, I'm able to take all of that stuff to the next level. I am absolutely elated that Canva Pro has decided to sponsor the podcast, because really, Canva Pro is the easy to use design platform that has everything you need to design like a pro. So whether you're a professional designer or just getting started, Canva Pro really can help you boost you and your team's productivity, which is super important, and creativity, which is equally important because I'm a creative person. It's really quick, easy, and it's affordable. All of this will help you take your design to the next level and design whatever you need. I mean, there's the ability to have a brand kit. There's an ability to just say, hey, you know what? I have my assistant that I want you to build some really great podcast artwork or this great asset that we're going to download, for example, for the Big Ready, for any of the stuff that I want to share with people like you. We get it done in Canva Pro. I can say what I want to look at. I can say what I want it to be like, and it doesn't take as much effort to make that happen inside of Canva Pro. So no matter what you're creating and sharing, Canva Pro has everything you need in one place. There's a collection of over 75 million premium photos, videos, audio, and graphics inside of Canva Pro. Plus, Canva Pro comes with time-saving tools that simplify and speed up the creative process. You can get all of this and more in just one Canva Pro subscription. I am a Canva Pro subscriber, have been before they joined on as a sponsor. Like I said, I was elated when they decided to jump on board. And my favorite feature, honestly, especially since I'm working with a lot of other people, is to have the brand kit in there. So I can easily share what our colors look like, our typography, all of that inside of Canva Pro. That's something that you normally get when you work with a graphics organization or an agency or something like that. It's inside Canva Pro. It makes it so easy to have different members of my team go in and they know where to go to get the assets they need to build the designs that we want. There's no idea that's too big or too small for Canva Pro. And if you want to save time, be creative, be productive all at the same time with a variety of features at your disposal, you're going to want to take advantage of Canva Pro and you're going to want to take advantage of this offer. So right now, I want you to design like a pro with Canva Pro. So right now, what you can do is get a free 45-day extended trial when you use my promo code. Just go to canva.me/timecrafting to get your free 45-day extended trial. That's canva.me/timecrafting. You're seriously going to fall in love with what Canva Pro can do for you, your team, your designs, your creativity, your productivity, and more. So again, go to canva.me/timecrafting and take advantage of this free 45-day extended trial right now. As I mentioned off the top of this episode, 2021 is looking up. There's new beginnings, and that means new opportunities to grow your business. Now, if part of your strategy is adding new members to your team, well, LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the right person quickly. And to make things better, your first job post is absolutely free. LinkedIn Jobs is the first place I go to now because it's super familiar. The platform is LinkedIn. I want to spend more time on LinkedIn. And the fact that I can find the right people, the right candidates for the job that I'm looking for inside of LinkedIn through LinkedIn Jobs makes it an indispensable tool for me. So here are some of the benefits of LinkedIn Jobs. First off, LinkedIn is an active community of professionals with more than 722 million members worldwide. That's a lot of people. And getting started is easier than ever because there's new features that help you find qualified candidates quickly. You can post a job with targeted screening questions and LinkedIn will quickly get your role in front of more qualified candidates. You can manage job posts and contact candidates from a single view on the, as I mentioned, familiar LinkedIn.com. So functions, they're all streamlined onto one simple screen. That makes it super simple and productive to use LinkedIn Jobs as the place to find the candidates you're looking for to take your business to the next level. And now you can do all of this from your mobile device as well, no matter where the day takes you. That's how LinkedIn Jobs can help you find the right person faster and hire them. When your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. And now you can post a job for free. All you need to do is visit linkedin.com/timecrafting. Again, that's linkedin.com/timecrafting to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Don't delay. Take advantage of this opportunity today. Go to linkedin.com/timecrafting and post that job for free today. All right, we're going to slow things down for a second here so that you can ask yourself this question, which is a question that I ask myself quite regularly. Is something preventing you from achieving your goals? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a piece of technology standing in your way or a set of circumstances that is constantly happening for you. But maybe you're feeling overwhelmed. Maybe you are having some issues that need resolve, that need some form of resolution so that you can move forward and get things out of the way so that nothing is really interfering with your happiness. Well, I can say from personal experience that there are moments where I feel that something is getting in my way. And sometimes that's me, right? And sometimes it's a variety of things. And I have to say that BetterHelp has helped me figure a lot of that stuff out, because BetterHelp assessed my needs and they matched me with my own licensed professional therapist, and they can do the same for you. One of the great things about BetterHelp, among the many, is that you can start communicating in under 48 hours with your matched therapist, and you can connect in a safe and private online environment. It's really convenient. Now, I want you to keep in mind that BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There's a variety of ways for you to connect with your counselor. You can send a message to them anytime, and you can also schedule weekly video or phone sessions. And by the way, you get timely and thoughtful responses when you do connect with your counselor. And you can do this all without ever having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. You can do this from the comfort of your own home, which may, in my case, I can tell you, help me open up a little bit more. The comfort factor has definitely helped me open up more when I'm dealing with my BetterHelp counselor. And BetterHelp, by the way, is also committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. So what they do is they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. That could be a result of time zone instances, things like that. I know I've had to make that happen, and it was a frictionless process. BetterHelp is also more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. The service is available for clients worldwide. You know I'm in Canada. I've got access to BetterHelp. And you can find the particular expertise you need online, so you don't have to limit yourself to the counselors located near you. There are licensed professional counselors who are specialized in things like self-esteem, anxiety, sleeping, anger, depression, and so much more. With BetterHelp, anything that you share is confidential. BetterHelp is convenient. BetterHelp is professional. BetterHelp is affordable. And there are so many people that have been using BetterHelp as of late that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today, because when you're happier, you're going to be more productive. And as a listener of the Productivityist podcast, you'll get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/timecrafting. Join over 1 million people, myself included, who have taken charge of their mental health. Head to BetterHelp, HELP.com/timecrafting, and take advantage of that discount that you get as a listener of the Productivityist podcast today. The future is happening now, and now, and now. That's right, the future is constantly approaching. And I'm putting together a free 3-day challenge to help you forge the future that you want. All you need to do is join me for this free challenge from March 26th to March 28th. By going to productivityist.com/forge-your-future. Your future is important. It matters to me. It matters to you. I want you to have the best future possible, and this free 3-day challenge is going to help you make that happen. All you need to do to sign up for this challenge is go to productivityist.com/forge-your-future. I'd love to see you there. And now, let's get back to the show. When I did the Big Ready, in February 2020, I had a definitive idea of what I wanted it to look like. Mm-hmm. And during the event, I can remember distinctly how I was watching, it was small. And I remember thinking, oh man, I'm disappointed this is small. I wanted more people here. Then as I watched the event unfold, and I remember just kind of looking out as people were doing some work for an exercise in a workshop that Marie Poulin was doing, I thought, no, this is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
It was really weird.
How many people were at it?
There's only 40.
Yeah.
But I had this in mind, and this is what it was supposed to be. And it just immediately, as I kind of came to that conclusion, or just came to that realization, everything lifted. Like, it just felt like all of that. And it was because of what was going on with the people that were there.
Yeah. No, I think that's a beautiful example too of like the host minds, like getting stuck in the organizer mindset, where it's like, you think like, man, I was hoping for 200 people. This thing looks pathetic. People who show up didn't know you're looking, you know,
no.
If you don't tell them, they don't know. There's 40 people. 40 people is still more people than I can meet in 2 days. So if you're running a 2-day event, 40 people's fine.
Yeah.
You're not going to, you know, yep. 40 people's a lot of people.
Yep. You know? Yep. And I mean, I guess this lends back to some of the stuff you talked about in the book about improv. Like I knew going into that event, I'm like, well, no matter what, I can improvise. I'm an actor. I mean, I can, yeah. I'm not going to be that person going up there. Well, I mean, I'm going to, you know, do the yes and this is the offer that's been get, like, I'm going to yeah. follow that back. And it, you know, it just worked to the point where yeah. people at the end of the event, I had actually said, cause I was only going to host it every 4 years on leap day. And I said, well, you know, we come back together in 4 years and they're like, what? We have to wait for, like, it was almost like, yeah. oh, wait, hold on. Sorry. yep. And sure enough, we're going to do it again. Right. Like it was one of those sure. things where I felt like this was what the event needed to be. And it made it worth all the more worthwhile.
Yeah. 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 That's great. That's awesome. And that's a big thing too. I mean, I think another thing too, is like the more, I mean, one thing I think I'm still learning thought, like I did improv for a long time. So I know this stuff from doing improv on stage, but I think I'm still learning this stuff really slowly in like life. But like the lesson I feel that life teaches me like again and again and again and again and again is that the way to make amazing things happen is to like have a plan, implement it, and then understand that it's not going to be what you expect, and right. then be like cool with the new thing that life gives you, you know, and to understand like how much, you know. So as an example of that, you now have this like beautiful, gorgeous annual 40 person event. That's not the event you were trying to make, but of course it's not. Like you can't, like all the learning in life happens by the interaction between like your brain and the world. And mm-hmm. I think I think in our culture, we're very inclined to think like, no, we can do it all in our brain. You know, we will plan out the entire conference
yeah.
and then it will happen the way it happened in our meetings when we thought about it and talked about it, but nothing actually happened. It's like, no, that's not how reality works. The way reality works is like, you know, and I think people are getting better at that, about rapid prototyping and minimal viable products and like experimenting and doing all those kinds of things where it's like, no, let's take a tiny idea and throw it against the wall and see what happens. And learning to be more like that, I think, is really helpful.
Well, and I think one of the things that the pandemic has had to teach us, and if we didn't learn this lesson, then good luck engineering certainty. In uncertain circumstances. I mean, we've had yeah. to embrace it, right?
Yeah. And I think it's been a really interesting time for that. Like, I think practically every person, I mean, I probably shouldn't generalize, but like so many people and organizations and teams and institutions have had to do more innovation and adaptation in the last 7 months than they did normally in a 5-year or 10-year period. And it'll be really interesting to see, like, when the pandemic's all over, what that does for people. Because a big part of me thinks that, an optimistic part of me, I suppose, hopes that a consequence of this is that we will all learn to be better at that. Like, to be better at change and to be better at trying new stuff and to be better at, you know. Here's a story that sticks in my mind from the pandemic. It's a story my dad told me about a friend of his who is a piano teacher. And she teaches these group classes for kids. And I think like at a bunch of times people are like, hey, have you ever thought of teaching the classes online? And she's like, I don't really want to do that. I mean, teaching in person is so good. Like I want to teach in person and I need that connection. And she had a million reasons she didn't want to do it online. Then the pandemic hit and she moved the classes online. And what she discovered within a half an hour was that teaching a group piano class to kids online is immeasurably better than teaching it in person in like 1,000 ways, because she can see every kid's hands at the same time while she can show them her hands. Like it was like, oh my God, it's incredible. And I think we all have, I mean, I know that I have two stories that are like that, but just not quite as clear, where it's like, there was some 30-minute experiment that she could have done that was available to her all the time. Like it wasn't like it never occurred to her. People are like, hey, why don't you try this? She's like, nah, it would take 30 whole minutes. I'm not going to take that. Like completely transformed how she, her professional practice worked. And I think for many of us, we're like, you know, there's things like that. I think that if you were to say to people in February, like, hey, here's an idea. What if every single office in the world just told everybody to start working from home on no notice? Like, how would that go? And we'd be like, oh, society would collapse. But guess what? It didn't. Everything kept running. Yep. Like everything was fine. It turned out. And if we were to say to companies like, hey, we want you to work on a work from home strategy to move your whole organization to work from home, they'd be like, okay, we'll work on that. It's going to take us like 18 months and $1 billion of consulting to figure out how to make that work. or you could just do it. Turns out you could just do it and it was fine. That's like a really surprising and interesting result. So I'm hoping we kind of learn from that. I don't know if we will. We might. I can see the opposite happening too, and everyone being like, I never want any change again.
Well, and the interesting thing is that the change begets more change, right? Like people who are now, you know, thrust into working from home, if they had been maybe a bit proactive about it, because it's not like it's a new thing. Remote work is, it's just there was a trust problem, right? Like I don't see the people working, therefore I don't know that they're working. But then when, but then the thrust so of, sad. You know, it, which is, but now what's so going to happen is, and it's like this idea of second, you know, cause and effect, second order think, whatever you want to talk about, where it's like, okay, now you've got companies going, oh, this is working. Well, we don't need this massive office complex in downtown Manhattan. And then downtown Manhattan, all of a sudden you've got massive amounts of real estate available.
Sure.
And the real, so, you know, I mean, in a, the ability, I think that's going to be the next thing. The next wave of things is going to be, oh, now we, what's going on with commercial real estate? Oh my goodness, internet at home prices go up because there's nobody using it from their work. So I think that there's always going to be these things happening and nothing stays the same. And I think that the best we can do is, I mean, we have to keep innovating, you know, small steps, big steps, however you want to. I think small steps lead to bigger steps in that front. But then where you can find certainty, know that that may too only be temporary, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, absolutely. It's not that it may be temporary. It is temporary.
No, yeah.
I mean, it's gonna be. That I think is a really important thing to get is like, oh, like if what you're doing is running around trying to find certainty, which I think most of us sort of naturally do, it's like, oh, you're just playing a losing game forever. If you're trying to find permanence and certainty, it's like, oh, you're either kidding yourself or losing just again and again and again. You know?
Yep. Misha, before I let you go, I want to ask you one final question. What's one simple action someone can take to kind of stay connected and keep conversations flowing during times where they feel like they have no element of control? Like how can they kind of keep things going when maybe they can't see each other, you know, where they're feeling like, and they don't necessarily like the idea of, you know, technology in the way that they're dealing with it and whatnot. Like what are some things people can do to just kind of either lean into that a little bit more, like, hey, you know what, the technology is what we need to be using, or just to feel a little bit more connected when, you know, they may not feel connected at all?
Try to get a realistic sense of what the risks are where you are and where you live. Because I think one thing that happened here in Toronto is like during the summer, it was pretty safe to go outside and have a coffee with someone. And I think a lot of people didn't quite grok that. And it's too bad because I think a lot of people missed their chance to go outside and have coffee with someone. So I think one thing is to try to understand the distinction between what's dangerous and what's scary. And if things are scary but not dangerous, maybe try to do them. Because I think for a lot of people in Toronto, going out and having a coffee with someone was scary but not dangerous. And getting past that's important.
Right.
I guess another thing that's scary and not dangerous in a very different way is kind of reaching out socially. And so I think one thing to think about is if you are in a situation where you really need, where your connections really need to be virtual, is to err on the side of reaching out, you know, to reach out to people you might not reach out to normally, to maybe be a bit more vulnerable than you otherwise would, to talk about that. If you're feeling isolated, maybe to talk about the fact that you feel isolated. I think there's a real taboo about that. But I did this birthday party with my dad this weekend, and we, a big part of what we were trying to do is just getting reconnected to people. And one thing that came from that too, that I'll share with, I know you asked for a quick point.
No.
The quick point that I think to really think about for people that for me has been a very exciting part of this time is to realize that if you are in a place where you're really in lockdown, a friend of mine shared this comment in social media and it really struck me. And when we were really in lockdown, she was like, you know, when we're in lockdown, my friend down the block is just as far or as close as my friend in England. And to reconsider your social networks in those ways. And so I think one thing that for me has been really powerful about this time has been connecting a lot more closely with a lot of my friends from who live in different cities, with a lot of my friends who maybe I fell out of touch with because they moved away. So really think about the fact that, like, you know, you can meet for half an hour for coffee with, you know, that person who moved across the country if you're doing it on Zoom just as easily as with someone else. And you can also have a cocktail party where you get together six friends who haven't seen each other since college, or you can, so to really see those opportunities that come from being online and the opportunities to connect across geography and different times in your life. I think for me and for a lot of people I know, that's been really powerful. So that's something I would share. I'll stop now.
Misha, this has been a great conversation. I love
so how nice to talk to
just
you.
The flow has been great. And Where can people keep up with you and your work so that they can learn more about you?
I have a website. If you if you type Misha Globerman into Google, you just spell it however you think it's spelled. It doesn't matter. The AI will fix it for you. If you type Misha Globerman into Google, you'll find me. Probably the best place to follow me, really, is probably I have an email list. And if you get on that email list, it'll let you know when I'm doing classes and things like that, which will probably start to be online more. I'm on Twitter too. I don't do much on Twitter. So I don't know, LinkedIn. You always connect me on LinkedIn or just drop by. Drop by. I'm in the phone book. I mean, you did find it in Toronto.
Misha, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today on the Productivity
Podcast. So great to talk to you.
I think this is an episode that we'll need to return to on several occasions, especially once things start to open up a little bit, depending on where you are in the world. But I really want to thank Misha for taking the time to join me today. If you want to make sure that you hear other episodes like this one with great guests, like this one, then I want you to subscribe to the podcast. Sure, you're going to be able to not only hear what's coming down the pipeline very easily in this podcast app that you're listening to this program in right now, just by hitting the subscribe button, but also you're going to be able to easily search the archives, easy for me to say, and be able to listen to past episodes featuring guests like Derek Sivers, Gretchen Rubin, Laura Vanderkam, Chris Bailey, Cal Newport, etc., etc. There is a plethora of podcast episodes for you to explore, and it's far easier when you subscribe to the podcast to make that happen. So I want you to hit that subscribe button now in Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you are listening to this. That way you don't miss a single episode of the program going forward. Now it's time for me to go forward and for you to go forward with the rest of your day, your week, your month, whatever. I hope to see you again next time. Until then, I'm Mike Vardy, the host of the Productivity Is Podcast, reminding you to stop guessing and start going. I'll see you later.